Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with psychologist and co-author of Making Conflict Work, Robert Ferguson, about successfully negotiating conflict and tricky power dynamics. What do you think, Adam?
Christy, why are we talking about this?
I can't even believe it.
I mean, you know, you always want to, like, go first.
We're not going to do this. We're not doing this now.
Okay, we won't do this now? This is why we have Rob Ferguson on the phone.
We need a mediator. We sure do.
Christy and I get along really great, but that doesn't mean every relationship doesn't have some conflict.
Well, first we're going to do some research that matters. We're going to talk about a new urine test that can predict high-risk cervical cancer.
Some research about ways of perhaps intervening to prevent the spread of malignant cancer in the brain.
About pessimism maybe being bad for your heart.
And if you smoke, what is the risk of getting an abdominal aortic aneurysm, a potentially fatal form of the aorta?
All right, Adam, let's talk first about a urine test to predict high-risk cervical cancer. This is research done by Johns Hopkins Medicine to develop a urine test to try to sort out triaging abnormal pap smears to determine if they're at high risk for becoming more aggressive cervical cancers.
You know, there's been such an advance, Christy, in our ability to both treat and prevent cervical cancer, but still a major killer of women around the world. And it still requires, for the most part, for a woman to come in to get a pap smear to, you know, to see if there's any abnormalities, and there's abnormalities to come back and have more treatment. And so this particular research is wanting to just say, well, is there a diagnostic test we can do, perhaps in the urine, that can reduce the amount of testing that ultimately needs to be done once we've identified someone perhaps at higher risk?
Yep. I mean, we've made headway with the vaccine that we now have for HPV, for the virus that leads to cervical cancer in some cases, and pap smears. But this allows us to use urine screening as a way to quickly and inexpensively determine if a biopsy is warranted. So if someone has an abnormal pap smear, to determine if it's okay to watch and wait or to determine if they need additional biopsies. So this is a proof of concept study, and it's the beginning, but represents further research that is coming that's really shaping the way we're able to take care of patients.
And this was published in Cancer Prevention Research, and it was looking at this human cell DNA, multiple sources of it in the urine. And my quick read on it, Christy, is that if the test is negative, then it may mean that you didn't need to have further work done. You wouldn't have to go into maybe the more invasive diagnostic things. If the test is positive, you certainly would have to go on. It may not be good enough to say that it couldn't be a false positive. So there's more work that needs to be done. I think a little more information is useful.
Okay. Well, our next research that matters is on new information about how brain cancer spreads. And in fact, this was a research published in the journal Cell.
That's a concise name.
And it really gets down to the point. We're talking about cells in the human body. And about glioblastoma multiforme and how it is, we know, a highly lethal brain cancer, and it's known for its ability to relapse. So this is a study trying to look and understand how those cells break away and then what makes them then grow in other parts of the brain.
Yeah, this was actually done at University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and this is a complicated study with lots of kind of abbreviations. But basically, they were looking at a gene, which they call WNT5A, that this gene, when it's activated, allows these kind of these cells in the brain that normally would be okay to kind of transition and become cancer cells and to spread. And if they can potentially suppress this gene after it's been activated, they may be able to stop this. And they basically are now going to move this particular research into further trials. And I guess Christy and I are bringing this up because this is our second study in a row that really has to do with genetic markers for different diseases.
And this is the advances in science are exciting.
These are major advances. It's transforming right underneath our noses.
Now let's talk about noses. Do you snub your nose or do you turn your eyes up? This is about pessimism. So a pessimistic attitude increases the risk from death from heart disease. That's the bottom line. This is done by some Finnish researchers who followed over 2,200 men and women, 52 to 76 years old, and did some tests and associated their risk of death from heart disease.
So if I were in Finland and it were this time of year and I said, oh, it's dark all the time, that would be kind of a pessimistic attitude, though it might be true. And if I said, oh, it gets dark early, I get to go home a little bit earlier, I'm adopting an optimistic attitude. Now, the question is, does that pessimistic attitude lead to worse health outcomes? And does that optimistic attitude lead to better health outcomes? And I'd like to say both were the case. I'm not sure this research shows that.
So the start of the study, participants had six statements and they had to rate them 0 to 4 on a scale, how well the statement applied to them. So the text was either positive, for example, in uncertain times, I usually expect the best, or negative, if something can go wrong for me, it will. And they then recorded their cholesterol levels, blood pressure, blood glucose, and other health factors that could predict heart disease. And then they followed them over 11 years to see what happened.
Yeah, and 122 people died from heart disease. And after kind of controlling for the things that we know cause heart disease, they found that those who were the most pessimistic were twice as likely to die of heart disease. It didn't really show a benefit effects of being optimism, but I don't think there are any adverse effects from that, so I'll choose to be optimistic. This was in the BMC Public Health Journal. We think it's important. And Christy and I both are going to choose right now to be optimistic.
Let's choose to be optimistic. That's what my mother says. She says, you know, happiness is a choice, baby.
Oh, have to
can really turn on my southern accent on that.
Let's talk about our last research that matters, about smokers who have a higher lifetime risk of an abdominal aortic aneurysm, that growth of the big blood vessel, the aorta, that can rupture and cause people to die. But smokers who quit actually have much lower risk.
And we know this AAA can be dangerous, right? So for people who – we'll actually ask our health sciences librarians to put up a picture so you can understand what an abdominal aortic aneurysm is. But it's that main blood vessel supplying the blood to the lower body. When it becomes enlarged or bulges, it can be treated if detected. But if it tears or ruptures, about 1 in 5 people will die. So this is significant. And based on the results, we already knew that there was this relationship. But they calculated that for participants who began the study, 1 in 17 would go on to develop one of these AAAs, including 1 out of every 9 current smokers and 1 out of every 12 former smokers.
And we do know that the guidelines for screening do recommend ultrasound screening for current or former male smokers between the ages of 65 and 75. So I think if you are someone who smokes, you're in that age range, you really should talk with your doctor about whether screening is indicated. It can be life-changing. Also, let's really emphasize smoking cessation. It lowers that risk. There's that optimism.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Don't forget, you could quit.
You can quit. We'll ask your mom to talk to all of
to give you something. You could quit.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with psychologist and co-author of Making Conflict Work, Robert Ferguson, about successfully negotiating conflict and tricky power dynamics. Listen to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's No. 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I get to talk with psychologist and co-author of Making Conflict Work, Robert Ferguson, about successfully negotiating conflict and tricky power dynamics.
Welcome to Your Health, Rob.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, it's really exciting to have you here and to talk about something that I think is a hard conversation, which is about conflict in relationships, how this plays out in terms of people's health. But I think we'd first like to know a little bit about you. How did you get interested in becoming a therapist? And of all the things you could do in therapy, how'd you get interested in conflict?
Okay, there's a story behind that. I've been a therapist for 27 years. And even before I was a therapist, I was always fascinated by the tension or the disagreements between people who actually care about each other. So I do a lot of marriage counseling. And for about 20 years, I've been active in helping organizations deal with conflict between people who aren't necessarily close in the sense of family relationships, but they work together every day and they run into a lot of tension and conflict. And I wanted to help with that.
How did you get interested just even in this idea of therapy?
Well, I grew up in a family, and there is no family without conflict, because conflict is the price you pay for honesty and closeness, actually. If you're close to somebody, you're eventually going to disagree with them, or you're not really saying what you think. So there was I grew up in a good, healthy family, but it still had a lot of conflict in it. And then when I got into my 20s, I became more interested in psychology, and I wanted to know more.
Well, your book, Making Conflict Work, deals directly with the concept of conflict, and yet that's something that we often like to avoid or sort of brush under the rug in families or not take head on or talk about relationships but not really deal with the conflict at hand. And we kind of alluded that conflict can have a detrimental effect on a person's physical and mental health. Help us understand the relationship of those health effects from conflict and perhaps conflict being brushed under the rug and not addressed.
My co-author, Dr. Peter Coleman, and I like to distinguish between healthy or constructive conflict, conflict that's well managed, and destructive or hurtful conflict. The very word conflict tends to make people nervous. So we're not talking necessarily about people yelling at each other, although unfortunately that happens too much in organizations and families. We're talking about simply disagreeing with someone. Disagreements that are poorly managed, and we'll say more about power later, tend to create a lot of stress. Stress, in turn, can lead to problems sleeping, mental health problems like anxiety and depression, marriage problems. So people take home what happens at work, and that can lead to pretty serious problems.
When someone comes in to see you in the office, a couple or an individual, is it obvious to you that connection between conflict and potentially poor health? And if it is it obvious to the person who comes in? How do you help people make that connection? Because I can imagine, yeah, I've got high blood pressure. Yeah, I get stressed. But for me to recognize that those two things are related may not be so obvious.
Well, that's a good point. Some people don't see it. And I don't necessarily see it right away. I've got to get to know someone as a therapist. It can take several sessions to really understand, why does this person have high blood pressure? Why is this person having trouble sleeping? Why are they depressed? And I peel back the layers of their life through a series of interviews. And often I find there is conflict behind whatever their mental health symptom is. It's either conflict at home, so as I said, I deal with a lot of marital conflict, or conflict at work, or both. Over time, because that's an important idea here, over time, conflict leads to both mental and physical health problems.
And so let's get into power. Tell us about power and how that affects both your reflections on conflict and one's health.
Power we define as the ability to make things happen. So it's associated with resources, money, title, a position in an organization. Clearly the CEO has more power than a middle manager. And power helps you get things done. How it interacts with conflict is that most books, in fact, some very good books like Crucial Conversations and Difficult Conversations, they offer some very good advice about how to manage conflict. But they rarely, if ever, discuss how conflict is complicated by power differences. So if I disagree with a peer at work, well, that's difficult enough. But what if my boss disagrees with me? Or what if I'm the boss and I'm trying to get my subordinates to be honest with me, to give me their best creative ideas? People tiptoe around conflicts when they are associated with power differences.
So can you think of any any example of something that you've seen that you can share in terms of the work or even the home environment of how power differential comes to play? I mean, I think about, like, is this a gender? But it's not all gender related, clearly.
No, it's not. People tend to have habits or mindsets associated with conflict. So in the workplace, it can be contrasted like this. There are people who basically feel like, if I have the power, I can tell people what to do. We call that the dominant mindset. There's a place for dominance in the workplace, but if it's a mindset, then every time I, the boss who believe that, disagrees with somebody, I'm going to just assert dominance to supposedly resolve the conflict. So probably men do that more than women in the workplace, but there's plenty of women who play that card. Contrast that to people who think the only way to manage conflict is win-win. Let's talk through it. Let's find common ground. Well, that works quite a bit of the time, but when it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So our book explores sort of a toolbox of different approaches to conflict so that you're not stuck with one tool.
So let's look at this briefly from the opposite angle. Are there positives to conflict and negotiations of power that you might share with us?
Absolutely. There are many positives, and we document them in our book. Like I said before, in an environment where people feel like it's okay to disagree with their boss or with a subordinate, there's going to be more honesty, higher levels of trust, and teamwork is going to be better. And if you're trying to get creativity and innovation into your team, people have to feel safe. If I'm afraid to say what I think at a meeting, you're not going to find out my ideas. So healthy conflict, constructive conflict, brings out great problem solving, creativity, and honesty.
It seems to me that a lot of conflict occurs at almost a subconscious level. It's not like most people set out to create conflict, but it seems to occur because, you know, you're driving along and someone honks the horn at you. And, you know, by the way, I didn't sleep so good last night, and I woke up with four things on my mind, and then I got a call from a family member who's sick, and I haven't eaten, and then that person honks the horn, and all of a sudden, I'm angry. And then, all of a sudden, the next person who I encounter, they're getting like a basket full of bad eggs. Help us understand to what extent there's a cognitive process. What do we do to become aware of our own issues?
Yeah, we all have certain assumptions about conflict and about other people's behavior. Most conflicts, both at home and in the workplace, are like your example. They're accidental. They're not expected. You walk into the room and a family member says something harsh. Suddenly you're in a conflict you didn't expect. And what you believe about conflicts is going to have a lot to do with how you resolve them. If you believe you have to win, or if you believe you have to lose, or if you believe you're powerless, that conflict is going to play out in a different way than if you think, I have a right to be here, I have a right to my opinion, and I'm going to work this out with the other person. It's more complicated when power is involved, power differences, which would really be most of the conflicts in the workplace. Most of the conflicts, at least the stickiest ones, are between boss and subordinate. So what you believe about power, your basic beliefs about power, are also going to shape that conflict.
Well, we are looking forward to continuing this conversation as we are working to create cultures of honesty and integrity in our workplaces, in our family dynamics at home, and in our communities. But we do need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, psychologist and co-author of Making Conflict Work, Robert Ferguson, about successfully negotiating conflict and tricky power dynamics. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with psychologist and co-author of Making Conflict Work, Robert Ferguson, about successfully negotiating conflict and tricky power dynamics. And before the break, you shared with us a little bit about these differentials in power and how they can really affect conflict in the workplace and at home. Share with us an example of a tricky power dynamic and maybe an approach that you include in your book about how to approach that power dynamic in a way that then makes it functional conflict.
Let me tell you the story about Christine, a woman who we interviewed for our book. That's a pseudonym. But Christine told us about a situation she was in. She was an administrative assistant, and she worked for a boss who it would probably be accurate, if not flattering, to call him a dictator. He was one of those bosses who thought he was always right, told people what to do, a micromanager, and he was argumentative. So you found yourself in conflict with him all the time. So Christine explained that she thought about quitting the job, but she needed this job, she needed the money, and she liked this company. She wanted to stay with it. And that's one of the lessons of conflict is you've got to know your goal. And then she was determined to make the job work, and she often used a phrase, just because I have less power doesn't mean I'm powerless. And so she worked with her, as I said, dictator boss, and found ways to not be powerless, both in her mind and her behavior. So one of the things she did, and we explain how to do this in the book, she created dependence. She made it so that her boss depended on her to arrange his scheduling. She became an expert in certain software that he needed to produce reports for corporate. And the more dependence she created, the more she had sort of a secretive kind of power. He had to stop being as argumentative and less of a bully with her because he needed her. So that phrase that she taught us is one of the themes in our book, especially when we talk about people in low power. Just because you have less power doesn't mean you're powerless.
It's the secret sauce of making conflict work.
Exactly.
You know, it seems as if you talk about the family situation, and I wonder if we could just spend a moment talking about children and children in families, the conflict over raising children and the stress of that. Does this play out the same way, or is there something different?
Well, there's similarities in that there's power differences in a family. The adults, the parents, need to have more power than especially small children. It gets more complicated in adolescence, but you can't claim that the parents have equal power to kids or it won't work. So there is the power difference. There should be power equality between two spouses. Once you introduce a power difference there, it's much harder to be close. It's harder to love each other. It's harder to be relaxed. But the difference between power differences at home in a family and power differences at work is you can quit a job pretty quickly. You've got other options, especially if you have a good resume. You can walk. In family life, it's much harder to distance yourself from somebody who's being conflictual or difficult, and we care. We're connected. We're attached to our family members. The emotional bond in a family is thousands of times stronger than any bond you could ever find at work. So we sometimes call that intimate conflict or the conflict of close relationships. And there, the goal between two spouses is to have equal power. We're going to find out the solution to our differences without either one of us dominating. In terms of parents to children, it's not that children have no power, because if you've ever seen a kid throw a tantrum, you know they're not powerless. But we want the adults to assert their authority, sometimes in a dominant way, but it's not harsh or cruel dominance. In fact, one of the reasons we wrote this book is to reduce the amount of abuse, frankly, that happens both in the workplace and at home.
And it's tricky in raising children to have those conversations openly. We were just having one last night with our son about our duty to train him up, to keep him safe, and like digging into some of those potential resentments or other conflict around that power differential and us needing to discipline him and make sure that we keep him safe. These are really, really difficult
things.
And
he listened to you because he knows you love him.
Yeah.
That you're for him, that you're
we're,
loyal. You're
we're
not
team
just
page. We're all on the same.
Exactly. You're not just some
team.
Impersonal boss who's asserting your
right.
authority. You're asserting your authority over him to protect him, and he at some level knows, oh, that's also love.
Right.
So that's the win-win.
That's a win-win in a happy, healthy family or workplace where no one is using their authority abusively or too much. That's when we go for the classic win-win.
So what's this? What's one of the most important steps that gets neglected in going from the win to the win? Because it seems like it's real easy to go from the win to the lose. The lose-lose, you know. But to go from the lose to the win or the win, I mean, how do we create the wins?
Okay. The most important thing in order to create wins, and this is sort of something that should be happening on a daily basis, almost in the background, is relationship building. A conflict doesn't just happen out of context. It happens in the context of a relationship. So, Adam, if you and I had a conflict, if we were coworkers and we had a conflict and we hadn't talked to each other for a month, you don't smile when you walk into the office in the morning, you don't listen to me at meetings, our conflict is probably going to be pretty nasty or at least harsh and strained.
I'm sorry, Rob, I should have done all those.
My guess is you probably would in the workplace. If we had a rich relationship where sometimes we went to lunch, we listened to each other about the things happening in our lives, we joked around some, and then we disagree, we now have a platform that's more likely to take us to a win-win solution. So relationship building is the often neglected ingredient in healthy conflict.
And so as we're coming to the last chapter of our conversation, what are some best practices or some takeaway message that you'd really hope our listeners would gather from this interview and then lead them to go read your book?
Probably in addition to the idea that relationship building is always important, always. We would encourage your listeners and the readers of our book to not fall into the trap of thinking conflicts are resolved basically by listening to each other and finding common ground. Let's go for the win-win. Of course, that's the ideal. We want it. But what we did in our book, based on a lot of research and interviews with a lot of people, is to try and help people see that just like a doctor needs a diagnosis before he or she can apply a treatment, we have to diagnose the conflict. There are several different kinds of conflict that happen in an organization according to power differences, personalities, the goals of the organization. And if you just have sort of a one-size-fits-all approach to conflict, that would be like a carpenter going to work with one tool. And you can't do carpentry without a full toolbox. So we encourage people to think about conflict as a more complex area that we need to understand how to diagnose the situation before we resolve it.
So we're going to encourage our listeners to get your book as we have, and because we think that it's important and it can help improve work life, home life. Though I want to ask you, your title of the book, the last thing is, it says Making Conflict Work, and the work has its own particular color, suggesting that there is work involved in this approach. Maybe homework. Do you have any homework for our listeners in addition to purchasing your book?
Well, in addition to purchasing our book or learning more at makingconflictwork.com.
Hey, shout out. Makingconflictwork.com.
Sounds good to me.
We encourage people to talk about conflict. Like, let's not wait for there to be a conflict. Let's sit down and talk with our colleagues, our associates, our family members, and ask the question, how are we going to work out our differences? How do you like to work with me if I disagree with you, if I have a different opinion? Let's do some groundwork before we get to the conflicts, especially the sticky ones, and understand each other's personalities and value sets and our basic assumptions about conflict before we, like your example of being caught in traffic and people are honking horns, before we're surprised by a conflict, let's map it out on a very personal level through conversation.
And some ground rules for if and when, not if, when it occurs.
Yes.
Here's one or two things we should do, which for me would be, don't say anything for about 30 seconds.
Definitely take a time out if your blood pressure is high or your heart rate's too high.
We're going to all meditate. We're going to lower. And I think reading your book will help us get there.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
We want to thank you for taking the time with us today, for sharing some of your wisdom, and to really get us thinking about how to make conflict work in our workplace and at home. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If any listener wants us to address any of their concerns on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about a listener who's trying to ask a doctor a question.
We're so meta. My doctor must be incredibly popular. It's hard to get an appointment. What do you think is the best way to ask a doctor simple questions? In person, online, over the phone, some other way?
Popular. I love that, the play Wicked. But in this particular case, I don't know if the doctor's popular or not, but if it's hard to get an appointment, you're not getting your questions answered. It could be they don't right. have availability like you would like. They could be popular, but they also may not be in clinic enough. Sometimes in academic health centers, the doctors may only be seeing patients 3 or 4 days a week, not like in private practice. But I do think the simple answer to what is looks like a simple question, but it's not, is in person, yes. Online, yes. Over the phone, yes.
All of the above.
All of the above, yes. Preferably not a text message to their mobile phone at 1 in the morning.
Sure.
Unless the doctor's giving you their text number, says, text me if you need me at 1 in the morning. Has the doctor ever given you their mobile phone number?
I don't think so. Not that I can remember, no.
Yeah. I do it occasionally, particularly for maybe some of the my older patients or people really, you know they're really critically sick. And sometimes, mm-hmm. If you really need me, the regular channels are electronic health record system. But, sometimes that's an impersonal system. You're not sure if someone really getting it.
Right.
Try to answer my own phone in my office when I'm there, have an assistant answer the phone. I do want patients to be able to get in touch if they need to. I mean, how do you want to get your questions answered, Laura?
Well, I find that, the online portal systems generally tend to be good, but I'm not shy about asking for appointments if I need to. I'll just call and try and book an appointment as soon as possible if there's something pressing that I'm concerned about, or I'll shoot my doctor an email.
Yeah. One of the things I like is I love the correspondence. And I think sometimes I think, is this something that's going to take about 15 minutes? If the answer is 15 mm-hmm. minutes or maybe longer, I might say, why don't you come in for an appointment? Here's a short answer.
Mm-hmm.
If it's going to take 2 to 3 minutes, well, let's just go in and try to handle that and talk about it. So
right.
sometimes it depends on how many questions there
right.
are. And is it really a simple question like, I was given 3 medicines by another physician when I was out of town and I'm having a skin reaction and here's a picture of the skin mm-hmm. reaction. And I'm also feeling nauseous. What do you think I should do? Well, okay, that's one of those ones I'm probably going to need to see you.
Yeah, it's hard to do that over the internet. You might not be able to exactly tell what's going on from a picture.
Right, but I don't mind the question. And I think,
right.
again, get in touch. But if it's something serious, just, get an appointment. Come on in. That's what we want.
Great.
What's our very next house call?
What are some causes of frequent bad breath, assuming you have good oral hygiene? What other than constantly chewing gum and mints can you do about it?
Well, bad breath, which we call malodorous, bad odor, 25% of people who come into a doctor may have that experience. And, it is a problem. And mm-hmm. it usually comes from the mouth. It usually originates from overgrowth of bacteria in the mouth. There are a lot of things that can be done, ranging from getting proper dental care mm-hmm. on a regular basis. You can use the mouthwashes and can gargle with them, particularly at bedtime. You can avoid foods that have more fibrous or nature. The fiber is good for, obviously, for the bowels in different ways. Sometimes I'll just recommend something simple like chewing gum.
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol, coffee in excess. I mean, these are just common sense. I guess one of the other questions is, do you tell someone when they have that? Is that an act of kindness, and how do you do that? Because I think sometimes people may not know.
Yeah, I know. We need Emily Post to help us out with that one, I think.
Yeah, well, we'll wait for a listener to weigh in and ask us that question. I think you can offer someone a mint. You can offer them like a piece of gum.
Yeah, that would work. Yeah. That's low-key.
Yeah, and I just think, they're offering me a piece of gum. That's great.
Nice.
It's a win-win. What's our very next house call, Laura?
I'm a 45-year-old woman, and I've been feeling exceedingly tired in recent weeks. What do you tell your patients who experience general exhaustion?
Well, here's what I don't say. I don't say, me too.
Yeah, well.
You know, it's like nothing seems worse than, like, you tell someone, God, I'm feeling really stressed, and the person you're telling to goes, yes, so am I.
Yeah.
It's like, well, wait a second. I need you to validate my stress level
right first.
And you don't ever want to hear, well, you know, compared to my day where I work 14 hours a day, that doesn't work either.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important just to say, you know, first off, validate, you know, when you're feeling overwhelmed and exhausted, that's really a bad feeling. You have to go to bed when you get home from work.
Mm-hmm.
When you get up in the morning, you're still feeling, you know, pretty tired. That's not good. And is it out of the normal? I don't know if you've had experiences where you've just, like, at some times in your life felt really exhausted.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can always tell when I have a sleep debt built up or something, when I end up napping on the couch.
Sleep deprivation.
Yeah, exactly.
You call it the sleep debt.
sleep debt.
Oh, sleep debt. I thought it was like sleep debt. Like, that's the lingo for deprivation. But sleep debt,
yeah,
so or sleep debt.
I'm coming up with a cool new phrase. But, yeah.
It's
no,
not
it's,
good.
It doesn't feel great. And when, you know, I'm falling asleep in the middle of the evening, you know, when it's time to hang out at home and be with my family, that's always a challenge.
We haven't even talked about all the medical problems.
Right.
Right. But a lot of people come in and say, you know what, I think I could be anemic or my thyroid's off. Now, those two things are possibly true, but the likelihood of either of those causing the fatigue is really low compared to all the things that we've just been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And depression, let's just name it, that sometimes is really frequently a cause of exhaustion. And how does that work? That's complicated. But it's important, and let's ask the question or we'd never diagnose it.
Right.
Good question. What's our very last house call?
I've recently been experiencing GI upset, and I'm wondering if I could be gluten intolerant. What are the symptoms of that?
Well, there is a lot that we should talk about. First, really, is about kind of gluten sensitivity, allergies to wheat, or people who develop kind of intolerance to these products. And the celiac, which is one type of this reaction, is this immune reaction to the protein that's found in wheat and in barley. And for most people, they have, you know, kind of some characteristic symptoms. They really will have GI upset. They'll oftentimes most frequently have diarrhea, and they will actually be losing weight. Now, with very mild cases, it can be much more subtle. And we've actually had one of the great guests from Chicago on our show a couple years ago talking about celiac and emphasizing that there is a whole host of conditions. So someone has unexplained neurological problems. Think about celiac, because it can affect all the organ systems and be very, very subtle and more difficult. There's a test you can do. It's not totally inexpensive, but you can go to your doctor. You can get tested for celiac disease. A lot of people, the easiest thing is to do what's common sense, which would be
cut back on gluten.
Cut back on gluten and see what's going on. The thing is that some things resolve spontaneously. You cut back on gluten, you feel better. It may or may not actually be to the gluten, and then are you restricting yourself? But, you know, if you feel better and you're eating gluten-free, that's great. Like, hard to beat doing well.
Yeah. If you're feeling okay, it's hard to criticize it.
That's right. Well, we want to thank these house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today. You can send any questions to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search for our health app, one word, Your Health, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Robert Ferguson. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we want to thank you, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.